Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The New Statesman.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Britain editor Anoush Shakelian. At the beginning of February, I travelled to Liverpool to interview two regional mayors, Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, and Steve Rotherham, metro mayor of the Liverpool City region. This episode was recorded on the 5th of February, 3 days before Labour rode back on its pledge to invest an annual £28 billion on kickstarting a green industrial revolution. We did discuss this proposal during the conversation, some of the contents of which are a bit out of date now. Their new co-authored book, Head North, A Rallying Cry for a More Equal Britain, chronicles their intersecting journeys in politics, the career paths which brought them to Westminster, and ultimately their joint decision to leave Westminster in order to effect greater change for the regions they represent. I spoke to both of them in Steve Rotherham's mayoral office, situated high above the surrounding buildings with sweeping views of Liverpool, across the yawning Mersey River and far into Birkenhead. To begin, I wanted to know, what does this city mean to both of them?
What does it mean to me? Genuinely, everything. It's a city that I'm fortunate enough to have been born in, but I've stayed most of my life. I worked away at times to try and find work, but I absolutely love it. It's not just a place that I live and work in, but it's a place that I support, and I love the people, and you know, it's a fantastic city. If anybody's visited, you'll know how beautiful it is. You know, it's really well appointed. It flows really well. It's had a particularly bad rap at times in its history, but most people who come here do go away with a very, very different perception of what they've previously read.
My Irish ancestors came over and worked on this place just in front of us in the 19th century. But when I was young, I moved more towards Manchester because my dad got a job over there. So, you know, while I've very much got that Liverpool ethos, if you like, as Steve's describing, I've always been of both cities, really, growing up. And I think, you know, the two cities are kind of similar, but great in their, as well, in their own character. And I think that's what makes the Northwest, you know, I would say the Northwest is the place where things are happening right now. And, you know, we're quite proud of that.
And of course, we worked in Westminster together, so that's why we've both lost our accents.
Steve Rotherham and Andy Burnham first met in Liverpool around 15 years ago, when Burnham was Culture Secretary and Rotherham was Lord Mayor of the city.
You know, I think the book describes the fact that we were born 3 miles or so apart, and our paths never crossed until mid part of 2008, as you know, we started to turn up at events together. I used to shun him because I thought he was a Lib Dem, because the Lib Dems were in control of the council at the time, and that we then were able to start working together in 2009. Which in any way was always going to be a monumental year, wasn't it, for the city of Liverpool?
Incredible year for Liverpool. Obviously, it was going to be the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough. On the 19th anniversary of Hillsborough, you know, there was still no hope of truth and justice ever coming to light, and of those families, you know, at long last being able to get death certificates that actually had the reason that they'd lost a loved one, or more than one in some cases. But it seemed like a forlorn hope. And yet by the 20th anniversary, when Andy addressed the COP, then things started to change really in our favour.
When Andy Burnham was Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, he addressed the crowds of almost 30,000 at the Hillsborough 20-year anniversary memorial service in Anfield Stadium, Liverpool. This was interrupted by a significant proportion of the crowds who shouted, "Justice for the 96.
But today, as the Prime Minister has asked me to convey, we can at least pledge that 96 fellow football supporters who died will never be forgotten. And he asks us to think at this time.
The Hillsborough disaster caused 96 football fans tragically to lose their lives due to a fatal human crash. This number was amended to 97 in 2021. The families of the victims fought for decades against the police and the press's assertions that the fans were to blame due to drunkenness and hooliganism. During this conversation, I wanted to speak to Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham about their manifesto for the changes they'd like to see in politics. But to do this, it was important to draw on the political events that had shaped them as young men. The memoir opens with a dual account of their experiences of the 15th of April 1989. Andy Burnham was watching Everton play Norwich at Villa Park, whereas Steve Rotherham was actually at Hillsborough that afternoon. Throughout the book, they refer back to this event. How did it shape them as people and as politicians?
Well, you see this now is only with the post office scandal, and it was decades after the actual thing happened, when somebody does something and then he brings that, or she brings that, to the attention of the whole country. And we were trying to do that, you know, perhaps not to the same degree, but we thought music is a very powerful tool and it's been used to great effect in the past. And we thought we'll try and bring a single out so that people will understand that we haven't gone away.
In 2012, a group of singers and musicians who went by the Justice Collective released a cover of He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother to raise awareness of the Hillsborough Justice campaign. The group included Jerry Marsden, Robbie Williams, Rebecca Ferguson, Shane McGowan and Paul McCartney.
Because on the 19th anniversary, there were only, you know, a few thousand people who went to that service because the government beat you down. That's the whole problem with these things taking so long. It's like a war of attrition. And some people thought we're never, ever going to see anything come out of this and not give up hope, but weren't as active. And then we tried to reinvigorate it. And obviously that then led on to the famous episode where, you know, I asked Andy that, would he speak at me? Well, I didn't ask him at all. And that
he said, you're going to be there.
My invitation was, you're speaking. Yeah. You're speaking at the 20th anniversary. And he, like, really? And then Andy thinking about that. And again, Margaret Aspinall comes into the picture because the person I'd agreed that with was unfortunately, well, Philip Hammond was the chair of the Hillsborough Family Sport Group and he got really unwell. And Morgan Aspinall stepped in. And after I'd said that to him and he'd sort of tentatively agreed, I said to Margaret that we've invited Andy to the 20th anniversary. And she just went, okay, even though she knew that was going to be a difficult thing to get all of the families to agree because politicians had let them down year after year after year.
And you described sort of in really viscerally how it felt. And the sort of tensions that you felt, because it's interesting, because you, when you both took up your first political positions, Hillsborough was almost the first thing that you were thinking about, wasn't it? And you suddenly shipped from this position of someone who feels keenly the injustice of the victims and the, you know, the way that politicians have treated the scandal, to being a part of the establishment, whether as a councillor or whether as a junior minister trying to bring it up and not getting anywhere with it. And that must have been sort of quite a conflicting position to be in for both of you.
Absolutely massive. You know, for me, I've always described it as the moment when my professional life to that point and my personal life came into a head-on collision. Mm. It was that bad. It prompted a personal crisis when Steve invited me because I just didn't know what to do. I always say I took my first steps out of Westminster the kind of day I walked forward to address the COP, for sure. You know, I was never the same politician after it. The kind of the agony of deciding whether or not to go, but then deciding to go And it was on my brother's advice that I was going to follow through for the families.
Yeah, because it's a theme running through the book, I think, this this tension between sort of being part of the establishment but realising how broken the system is from the inside.
I do say it at some point that in the end, you could be in with the sort of, you know, the set down there, or you could be true to your roots, but you couldn't be both. And I think it was quite revealing for me that I actually couldn't be both. You had to decide one or the other. So, you know, that says something about what the Westminster culture does to you.
I was slightly different because I never had any ambitions to climb the greasy pole down there. I think when I went down there, because I don't know how I ended up as an MP, because my predecessor, Peter Kilfoyle, who was a big figure down there, and he was stepping down and he just said, I think you should do this. And that's how I ended up doing it. It's not something I would have applied for, but he just said, I think you should do it. And I thought, well, yeah, no, I spoke to the wife and she said, yeah, let's do it. So I'd never even been in the House of Commons. I walked in the chamber and I was like, wow, it's not like on the telly. It's the opposite of the TARDIS, isn't it? It's a lot smaller in real life than you see it. But so we had very, very different ways in which we approached Westminster. But the book is not about Hillsborough or Westminster, really. It is that those things, if you like, conspired to turn us into the people that we are, and certainly the politicians that we became. And then the focus shifted away from sort of party politics on what could we do differently. And we thought with these new roles that were being put forward at the time, one for Greater Manchester, the devolution deal there, and one for the Liverpool City region, I wonder whether that might be something for us. And so we had a drink one day and we eventually shook hands on a deal and said, no, let's see if we can change the whole process of politics, but from the outside rather than from the Westminster inside.
And that was in 2016, March 2016, and so much has changed in politics since then.
Yeah, that's right. So I think I described this in the book. You'd originally tried to persuade me to do it, and I'd lost to Corbyn, don't forget, just before, and I was, you know, in a pretty, you know, low moment, if you like. And you'd said to me, no, this is going to be right for us. I think it was just before Christmas.
He still blames me, by the way, for the loss against Jeremy.
I think I was largely self-inflicted. But I, you know, he'd said to me, what do you think about these positions? And I'd gone into Christmas 2015, as it became 2016, kind of thinking about it, but then came back to tell, I said, I'd thought about it, but not. I want to do something on the referendum. As I said to Steve, I want to, you know, really make a difference as Shadow Home Secretary on the referendum.
Yeah.
I had a big speech lined up here at the St George's Hall, and I wanted to make the patriotic case for Remain. Mm. And I went to the Remain campaign and I said, you know, I think we need to get into this kind of more emotional case. You know, the country created in many ways the European Union in the, you know, the thing we did, and the United States of Europe, as Winston Churchill once called it. You know, we played our role in that. And I tried to get the Remain campaign, the official campaign, and the Labour campaign to give my speech some prominence and, you know, work with me on it. And they just, no, we're not. We're making a different case to the country, a much more hard-headed economic case. And I went and did the speech, and literally there was just zero coverage of it. And I just remember thinking, that was the moment where I thought, they don't get it down here. They really don't get it. They don't get what's going on in the country. They don't. And I came back from that experience of making that speech, and I said to him, right, I'll see you in the pub after the vote. And that's when I said, right, I'm in, I'm leaving. You know, that was that experience in the Remain campaign.
And was it seen as quite an eccentric decision by some of your colleagues? Because it seems from the book that actually the party sort of HQ didn't give you very much support when you were going for your roles. And actually,
zero,
Steve, you described the first day of your job and you said there was a laptop and an empty building and not really much else.
And no, there was no support.
And
from
that's ironic given how much the Conservatives were championing the work of Andy Street in the Midlands.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, there was certainly that, I don't know, dichotomy between what we were trying to do, because we believed that we could quite clearly showcase in our areas things that the Labour Party would be proud of. And yet there was no support from the centre. They hadn't really caught up with the whole idea about devolution. And you know, that's really disappointing because if you go back a bit, we were the party of devolution. You know, Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales, the Welsh Assembly, that was Labour. And then to see them literally not have anything to do with it any further, and for then the Tories, from my perspective, for the Tories to rob our clothes and then start to pretend that they were a devolving and a decentralising party. Yeah, that really stuck in my craw, that one.
And how has that changed since then? Because I feel like there's been a lot more talk about devolution since you took up your mayoralties, and partly because, you know, yours came about and we've got sort of more metro mayors now. But also the levelling up agenda, okay, that's, you know, spluttered to a halt, but it was a big part of that pitch to the country from Boris Johnson's Conservative Party, and Labour sort of took it up as well. And then you have the take back control bill that Labour's promising to bring in if it gets into power. Again, there's not a huge amount of meat on the bones of that yet, but do you feel that there is more of a recognition from both of the main parties?
Can I just say something a little bit controversial?
Yeah.
That is that I think, because anybody could have stood for the Metro Mayor. And I think if it had have been a councillor, for instance, who had been appointed as a Metro Mayor in all the areas, then I don't think that you would have had the same attention from central government as what we got when a former cabinet secretary of state was appointed as one of those. So I think Andy upped the ante for everybody. And I'm not blowing smoke. I think that's what happened. The government started to say, oh my goodness, if we're getting the caliber of you know, Andy Burnham as one of these Metro mayors, we better start taking notice. And then when we did speak, I think there were seven of us at first, 3 Tories and 4 Labour. And so we were able to speak. In fact, I think it was the other way around. I think it was 4 Tories and 3 Labour. But anyway, we were able to speak cross-party so we could reach into government because we had that Tory support for what we were doing. And then that meant that all of a sudden people were listening to what we were doing in our areas, and then we've accelerated this. And then you've ended up with, hopefully, Andy and Andy Street getting these devolution agreements, which is a single pot settlement, which is genuine devolution. Up to them, we'd have a bit of decentralisation. But this could be really massive in regard to the change and the rewiring of the country that we're asking for in the booth.
We've lived this and we know this, and we can say it without any fear of contradiction from anybody. The north of England cannot get justice within the current political system. You know, we have taken this so far, but this alone is not going to change the country in the way that we believe it needs to change. You have to do a fundamental rewiring of Britain to make that happen. You know, if we're thinking of that German ideal of equivalent living standards, which is a different way of expressing levelling up, I guess, isn't it? Across all parts of the country, then you need, you know, substantial reform of Parliament, much more devolution, and in fact, more empowerment of individual people in relation to the basics of life, as we describe in the book.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This idea of rewiring Britain, which is laid out in your book, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be interested to see, it includes so many different things. You know, the potential removal of the whip system, for example, in Parliament, right up to full devolution, House of Lords reform. Is this the kind of thing that you are lobbying the Labour Party for? You know, we might see a change of government soon, and a lot of this stuff would have to come from central government.
This isn't just a manifesto for the Labour Party. This is something that we think that the country needs to do, because, you know, for the Northwest, read the Northeast, Southwest, East Anglia, you name it. All of these different places suffer versions of the same thing, which is a way of running the country that doesn't treat those places as the same as London and the Southeast. And we all suffer something of the same. So the plan that we've put forward is meant to appeal to anybody who feels, you know, unhappy with where the country's at. I think I say this at some point in the book, you know, we lived through Hillsborough, and that confirmed to us that we weren't
equal in our own country, that we were second-class citizens in our own country. And people from the north maybe have long felt that. But we appreciate that not everyone experienced Hillsborough in the same way. However, the whole country stopped in 2020 and watched the political system. And it was laid bare in that moment, wasn't it, where a cabal of people were taking ill-thought through decisions, foisting them on millions, not looking after people who were on the kind of lowest wages in the poorest housing. I think everyone at that point in time saw, right, the way this country is set up, it's way too dysfunctional. And I think that kind of sense now of things having gone backwards, things not working properly, I think it's quite profound, actually. And the thing is, it can't be fixed with a few policy commitments here or there. It is about the basic wiring of the place. It's not set up for success everywhere.
Burnham and Rotherham's book tells the story of the North-South divide in the UK being a deliberate political choice. One of the key signalers of this was the handling of the COVID pandemic, when decisions were made in London for the whole country, based predominantly on the situation in London, including allowances for furlough schemes, as well as tiers and restrictions. Another example is Andy Burnham's experience from the Treasury of trying to get transport upgrades in the Northwest and them not meeting the Treasury standards for return on investment. It seems that these things are wired into the system.
They absolutely are. And I say that was a big learning point for me at the 2007 spending review. Alistair Darling, you know, and it's so sad that he's no longer with us. You know, he was a big support to me at that time. One of the things he said to me was, put together a funding package for what was then Crossrail, now the Elizabeth Line, which I did. But I said to the Treasury, but I can't announce this without something for the rest of the country, particularly the North. And after asking and asking and asking, the list just kept coming back empty. And there was one thing in relation to Birmingham New Street, a feasibility into it, the rebuilding of it. And I said, well, why? Why is there no other project on this list? Oh, they didn't meet the Green Book, Minister. And I said, sorry, what is this? Explain it. And that was when the scales fell from my eyes. Basically, the country had been running a system, a permanent system under governments of all colours, whereby projects were only likely to succeed in the more affluent parts of the country because they would pass the BCR or the test that the Treasury sets. And it was then that I just realised that the money is dragging into London and the South East, the North-South divide, which I'd observed getting wider as I was going up and down the West Coast Main Line for 16 years as an MP. And I understood why it was getting wider. So for me, that was like a massive moment of, understanding that, as I say, it's no accident, the North-South divide. It is almost a deliberate national policy. And if you wanted to do something serious about that, you had to completely change the governance of Britain, which is what we're now proposing in the book.
Yeah. And so how do you feel, based on that assessment, how do you feel about sort of the Labour Party's leadership at the moment, which is very much in the mould of, we must meet our fiscal rules. We don't want to, do anything too radical. I know some of it may be sort of because we're ahead of an election campaign, but does it depress you given your prescription for how to change Britain far more radically than what we may be hearing at the moment?
It does depress me because this was never meant to be a magic wand that can happen overnight. This has to be over a sustained period. And some of it, we've said, I think in the book, is going to take some considerable time for us to get through. It's about trying to win hearts and minds this. There is an alternative. But what we're trying to do then is to say, as a package, this could radically rewire the UK. It could be a fairer Britain. It's a rallying cry for a fairer UK. So the whole idea is that, for instance, we look at where we could get significant change and there are pieces of legislation and constitutional change that would mean that whatever the type of government is in the future, that they would still have to abide by, for instance, trying to properly level up the country. So we talk about the basic law. The example that we give of what happened during reunification in Germany, and over decades, the differential has closed and closed and closed, where it's hardly discernible now. Whereas we believe that the differential currently between North and South is greater than a starting point for German reunification.
And it's not just a money thing, is it? Because some of the policies of the 1980s took power out of these places. for instance, something as simple as buses. You deregulate buses, what does that do? It basically empowers private vested interests and leaves the public with an unaccountable system that just doesn't work for them. Or you sell off council homes, you leave them in the hands of the private rented sector, and again, with the public unable to get the kind of service or the housing that they need. So, you know, for us, this is about that take back control bill is a good concept, isn't it? Because we are two mayors, the first two to put buses in England back under public control. We've both taken that decision. I've actually got those buses running in Greater Manchester. That gives a place agency again. You can run something as basic as your bus service. You can hold them to account if they don't turn up for people in the morning. You can set the fares that they charge. You can set the routes that they go on. I know it sounds small, but actually it's not in many ways. You know, just giving these great cities of ours, you know, just that ability to run the basics is a big deal, because since the 80s, they've not had that power. And consequently, things are as they are because, you know, we've been sort of disempowered and unable to sort of create the foundations for a more productive economy that is obviously a power that London has never lost.
Okay. And in terms of that take back control bill, I mean, there's been some reports recently that Labour might ditch its pledge to scrap the House of Lords. How do you feel about that? Because that is one of your asks in your book.
I've always believed in this. I mean, you can imagine, can't you, that from the area that I'm from, very few people make it into the House of Lords.
Well, more people, we're saying that, but more people born in Eton than were born in the Liverpool City. More people who went to Eton, I should say, than were born in the Liverpool City region or Greater Manchester.
And that's what you've got. And that then gives a very skewed perspective of the world. Look, do they do some good stuff? Yeah, 100%. There's some people in there, and some of the reforms that they pushed through the system have been really beneficial, but it's one dimensional. And what we need is something that's representative of different classes, but also of different parts of the country. And that's why we're saying it has to be representative of the nations and the regions, as well as the type of people that end up going to the House of Lords.
I think it's 55% of people who are current members of the House of Lords cite London and the South East as the location of their primary residence.
Right.
So, you know, here we are, we're in 2024 now, and you've got a city like this behind us, and it doesn't have the same representation in our national parliament. Now, how can that be? How can people not be outraged about that? You know, it's just unbelievable that we have an unrepresentative national parliament making the laws of people here, and half of it undemocratic. I mean, how has that happened? And I think you've made this point, Steve. The appointments to the Lords have become more and more political in recent times as well, haven't they? And, you know, it was one thing where you were appointing people who've really distinguished long careers. When I got 30-year-old advisors in there and God knows what. What on earth does that say to people in a place like Liverpool, you know, in terms of a parliament that simply doesn't represent them? I mean, it's got to change.
Yeah, and so would you say sort of Labour should stick to that pledge? I know there's been a bit of a wobbling on it.
Like, I would. You know. I'd say stick to it. It is a first order issue to me, a parliament that represents all people and places equally. And then secondly, stick to the pledge around transition, green transition. You know, that's the best possibility that we have sitting here today of a fund to reindustrialise the north of England in a good way. You know, Steve, we look out over the water there. You pick up from here, you have a plan for a tidal barrier, the first of its kind in the UK. That is what this is about, isn't it? Prosperity and future-facing industry in all parts of the UK. And Labour's commitment to that fund is really important in that regard.
And we're hitting the same barrier, tidal, as Andy described, with the fund and methodology, you know, the green boot.
Yeah.
Because what we're asked to do is, for whatever bizarre reason in the formula, but we have to prove that a Maisie Tidal project could provide a return on the investment in 45 years.
Right.
Now, the issue is that our Tidal project is 120 years. So there's actually 75 years, which is not included in the business case. And it's the BCR, the benefit cost ratio, that is the thing that they mark you on. So that's the determining factor of whether you get it or not. I believe two things. The first is that the funding methodology needs to include some sort of recognition of social deprivation or of geographical area. And then if for the emergency tidal one, we could get full life project of whatever it is that you're building and the whole thing is over that whole life, then the economics stack up.
In other words, rip up the green book.
I'd burn it.
That would be very environmental.
And so that £28 billion of investment that was is supposed to be coming sort of yearly, yeah, which you know, the figure is under contention now, that would help both of you in levelling up your areas, sorry to use the political phrase.
Well, it's the way in which we can make a change to a different energy system. It's the way in which we might improve people's homes here through retrofitting, but wider home improvement. It's the way we build future-facing industry. But what we do in the last chapter of the book is talk about, you know, the catalyst of net zero,
yes,
being a path to a new economy. So you put more of those essentials under public control so that you kind of make energy affordable to people. You reduce the running costs of people's homes as well as improve people's homes. I think what we're saying is, you know, we've had an extractive economy. The privatization of services, the deregulation of transport, that in the end has left people overpaying for the basics. And that's a bigger problem in Greater Manchester and the Liverpool City region, where people's incomes are lower. You know, those basics take a bigger proportion of your income. And that is, I think, what we've got to sort of change as a country. You know, we ended up in a cost of living crisis, unable to control the cost of energy, of water, of public transport, of, you know, all of these basics. These things cost more than people can afford on average incomes now. And I think we've got to use net zero as a catalyst to a new economy.
Yeah, we need to get back to being pioneers and these sorts of things. So where we are in Liverpool at the moment, out of the window behind you, there's an area called Burbo Bank, and that's an offshore wind cluster. Very, very profitable, very successful. Not a penny of it comes back onshore here, because it's the Danish government that's invested in that with Ørsted. And so that money's going outside of the country when we could have done that ourselves. Now, we lost out because we weren't first movers in wind, offshore wind, and we want to ensure that tidal we will be.
Yeah.
And the investment, the 20-odd billion pounds, whatever it ends up, it's got to be seen to be more than just projects about green technology. It is about the green industrial revolution, but it's about jobs and skills and doing things that we can export and creating real wealth for areas like ours. But also we've had some analysis done where the Northwest could be a net exporter of green energy to other parts of the country. Why wouldn't you invest in something like that? Because they are transformational, they're big changes that you can make. And it's about a lack of ambition. And it's also a bit about myopia with central government, because again, it's Green Book, it's Treasury, it's Business Case, it's BCR, and it's London. I mean, get out and have a look around at what the possibilities could be for areas like ours.
And so with all of this, public ownership, green investment, constitutional change, reforming the voting system, which we haven't spoken about, you know, are they things that you've spoken to the Labour leadership about? Are they the type of things you, I know that you say that this prospectus could be for a government of any party, but we're expecting, if the polls go the way that they carry on, to have a change in government. Is this something that you would like to see sort of in the first or second term of a Labour government?
Well, we obviously would like to see Labour move forward on these ideas, and I think they will. Certainly more devolution. We both are encouraged by the conversations that we're now having with Keir and the party over more power for mayors, which is great. We hope that they will stick to the plan to invest in green industry. So, I mean, there's lots of encouragement here, and obviously, you know, there's a challenging time, isn't it? When you're running an election campaign, I think the reality of being in government, I think, will probably mean that they do want to work with us very closely, because I remember in 97, there wasn't a regional infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that's different between then and now is there is an infrastructure.
But I think also the public out there are more impatient for change. They want to see better homes. They want to see better jobs. They want to see that transport infrastructure go in. And the thing is, we can do that. I think, you know, I don't think there'll be a great deal of patience. I don't think there'll be any honeymoon. I think people will need to see progress and progress quickly. But, you know, we're ready to work with Keir and the party to deliver a fully reformed bus system within a parliament, which is what we both definitely can do, to build 30,000 council homes in Greater Manchester, which is absolutely what we could do. We could demonstrate the delivery. And I think that starts to get quite exciting, actually, that prospect now of working with the Labour government.
That's the most important word, though, delivery. And whilst Labour have been out of power in Westminster for 14 years, they haven't been out of power. Labour's in power all over the country, and we've been in power for 7 years. So have a look at what we're doing, because it's a brilliant showcase for what you can do. Yeah. Even with limited powers, you can have a different way of working. You can start to pull things together. You can start looking about where the synergies between different things are. So in buses and rail, for instance, or in housing and decarbonisation, in industry and innovation. There's loads of things that we can do, and we are doing, because we have soft powers in some areas and we don't have the actual responsibility for these, but we're doing it anyway, aren't we?
Well, and for sceptics of English devolution, they should think about this. You and I have managed to overturn a key part of the Thatcher legacy from the 80s.
40-odd years.
Deregulated buses, and we've done it under a Tory government. Yep. So we've done that under a Tory government. Imagine what we could start to do if we had a government pulling in the same direction with us.
Yeah, and just lastly on this topic, is it true that Sue Gray has been instrumental in sort of bridging relationships between the mayors and the central sort of Labour Party?
It's been fantastic to work with Sue. I know Sue of old because I worked with Sue when I was in government. And it's just kind of interesting. I think, you know, she's come through her Whitehall experience with, feel like to me, with a real commitment to devolution. So yeah, things have really come on in the last few months, and I think there's a growing sense that we can really do something here together with the Labour government.
And on the question of Sue Gray, we mentioned, didn't we, earlier about the fact that we were abandoned basically by the party when we started, and she's been different gravy. Honestly, she's been brilliant for us, because you need a conduit between what's happening down there. I mean, she's provided that link, and I think the benefit of that will be to the party themselves, because hopefully we're influencing the way in which National Party is thinking about things, because they can see the delivery of those things. So they're not too onerous or difficult at times. If we can do it in each area, then that should be something that can be rolled out across the whole country.
And just lastly, because there's a big theme of this in your book, which I found sort of quite disturbing to read about the culture in Westminster and how sort of you both felt like it was quite exclusive when you joined, and, you know, you'd end up having pints with each other after late votes rather than going to the dinners and other things that a lot of people were going to. And I just wonder, you know, has that changed over the time that you've known Westminster or known Westminster politicians? And do you think any of your sort of solutions for change could bring about a cultural change? And
do you know what? Genuinely, I know it wasn't meant as a sort of a pointed question, but we didn't even have pints together. We didn't get involved in all of that sort of side of things, because I think it's quite corrosive for all of that. So on the odd occasion that we did say, should we get off the palace?
Right.
Go out somewhere. We'd meet up in a pub outside of all of that,
right.
And we'd go to I can't even remember his, but it was over the bridge anyway, on the left hand side, about a 15
symbolically important
15 minute walk. Yeah, just far enough away so that we didn't bump into all those people. But then we could talk about ordinary things as well as just politics, because it is very narrowly focused down there on, you know, what's happening in politics, because there's always a bill to read, or, you know, there's some voting that's going to happen, or somebody's doing. So we tried to have a normal, if you like, or semi-normal life whilst we were down there as well.
I mean, in the acknowledgements to the book, though, I do sort of thank
all the people I work with in Westminster. And I do say that, you know, I don't want to appear like I've got a complete downer on it, because some wonderful people, not just the MPs, but, you know, the staff of the Westminster. You know, I had really good memories of working with people. And I guess for me, it changed, obviously. There was that early part of my career, pre the work we eventually did together. And, you know, I was around in the Strangers and all those places. And, you know, but it was a slightly different thing. It was an experience of progressively falling out of love with Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally kind of got into that kind of phase, when I was sort of, you know, working in a different way, it was something where I kind of looked at it all with new eyes, really, and saw how difficult it was. The thing I would say is, you know, it is the system, it's not the people. You know, the vast majority of people in there are good. I say at one point, you know, 90% of MPs are good people trying to do positive things. It's just the system that does it to them, in my view. The problem with Westminster is it can make a fraud out of good people. You know, you're being asked to vote in certain ways that you may not fully believe, and say things that, you know, don't represent your views, with lines to take. You know, that isn't, in the end, a system that supports people to be good politicians, in my view. It almost does the opposite. It kind of makes them appear like something they're not. And that, I think, is the problem. You know, the system doesn't allow people to be the people that they went in there wanting to be, because everyone goes in there wanting to change the world, and you kind of discover that you can't, really, because of the way it's set up. So we think removing the whip system, reforming Parliament, would actually empower the status of our elected representatives and our MPs, and would be good for them as well. So, and it would make Westminster a better place to work. There was nothing more miserable on those nights when you're being asked to troop through the lobbies for something. You're like, people would say this phrase, hold your nose going through that. No, why should you do that? You know,
I think there'll be a bit of pushback on this. And do you know, out of all the things that we've suggested?
Yes, yeah.
I think this will probably jar with people down there who are in the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're not in any way suggesting is that we disempower them. We're actually saying the opposite, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're saying, you know, this will give you real autonomy to listen to debates.
Yes. In my experience, I say this a number of times, I think the whip system, what it does is it transfers power from elected people to unelected people.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, it gives power to a small, no more than 50 people, majority of whom are unelected, some elected within it in the cabinet, but it gives a lot of power to a lot of unelected people, and then allows that group to foist decisions on the country that MPs are just meant to rubber stamp on the whip. And that's the problem with it. You know, actually Parliament should take that power back and say, no, we're going to empower those elected representatives to use their best judgment, and that should make it the cockpit of the nation rather than rooms in Downing Street or the Cabinet Office. That's where decisions are being made often, as the pandemic showed. Parliament was completely bypassed in the pandemic, as far as I could see. And you know, people may not realise it, but sometimes Parliament is just providing a veneer of running the country. I mean, actually, it's still the same thing. The decisions are being made somewhere else.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my guests, Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham. This episode was recorded on the 5th of February and produced by Catherine Hughes.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.